Hello and welcome back to Creed and Culture. It's really exciting for me to have Professor Carl Truman on the show today. Exciting because I've just read one of his recent books, Strange New World. Really enjoyed it and really looking forward to discussing some of the ideas from it with him. Carl, welcome to Creed and Culture. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Luke. It's great to be on. Thanks for inviting me.
Good to hear it. Carl, do you want to tell our viewers and listeners just a little bit about your background, what brings you to the point you're at today?
Sure. Well, I grew up in Gloucestershire in England, went to the University of Cambridge where I studied classics with a particular focus on ancient history, then did a PhD in Reformation studies at the University of Aberdeen. And for the last 30 years, I've taught in higher education, first at the University of Nottingham, then at the University of Aberdeen, then at Westminster Theological Seminary, a Presbyterian seminary in Philadelphia, and latterly at Grove City College. The book we're going to talk about today, of course, is not the typical Reformation scholarship fare that I cut my teeth on. What happened about 10 years ago was while I was a part-time pastor as well as teaching at the seminary, I became fascinated by a number of the questions bubbling up in our culture relative to sexual ethics and also identity politics. And so I was fortunate to have a year at Princeton University before I went to Grove City College, where I was able to work on issues of identity politics, sexuality, and human identity. So that's the 32nd version, if you like, of how a classicist becomes a Reformation guy, becomes I suppose we'd say culture warrior over here, but I don't like that term.
I know. Well, it's a cult. Well, forget about the culture warrior side, but the classicist to theologian is a common route. We have Oliver O'Donovan on in a few weeks' time. Of course, he was a classicist first. And we had James Orr on a few weeks ago. He was a classicist first, became a theologian. Yeah. So it's a really good route, in my view. Now, I should say, so Carl's book is Strange New World, but it is the easy version of The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, which is much longer. My girlfriend Pauline loved that you've got the same color design for both books.
Yeah, nothing to do with me. That's the great designers at Crossway pulled that off.
Yeah. Excellent. So you start off Strange New World. Well, actually, the chap Ryan Anderson, who wrote the foreword, he started it off. And he's saying, in a sense, you're trying to make sense of the world we live in, where President Biden says transgender equality is a civil rights issue of our time. And Anderson says that is a statement that your grandfather would have immediately rejected, and I imagine would have been just completely puzzled by it, this idea that a man can become a woman. So what do you mean by this strange new world that we find ourselves in?
Yeah, essentially this, that the values, the moral framework, the ethical imagination of society. And I'm really speaking about the West here. I don't need to at the start say I'm not sure that my narrative works for other parts of the world, but I'm really thinking of Europe and North America. That the way we think about ethics, the way we think about morality, the way we think about identity has not only changed over the last 15 or 20 years, but has changed so dramatically that somebody like myself, you know, who's at university in the 1980s, or even who, you know, emigrated to the United States in 2001, can honestly say, wow, the world I live in today compared to 2001 is more different, for example, than if I was living in the year 1600 and comparing my life to what it would have been like in 1400. The speed and drama of the changes, particularly in the realms of identity and morality that we've seen taking place around us, are breathtaking, such that many of us, particularly an older generation, have a feeling of great disorientation as we look at the culture around us.
So you've said the change, can I get this right? The 20-year change that's happened recently is greater than the 200-year change that sort of happened during the Reformation time.
Yeah, or even better, probably Middle Ages. I mean, there are significant changes that take place at the Reformation, but they take...
Okay, so just before...
Yeah, they take 150, 200 years in the Reformation, of course, which is quite a period of time. But if you think about medieval Europe, if you were to go to my home village in Gloucestershire in 1200, hang out for a bit, and then time travel forward to 1400, other than the fact that the faces would have changed, pretty much everything, the rhythm of life, the way people think, the patterns of behavior that one would witness would have been substantially the same. Even over the last 20 years, even the invention, for example, of the smartphone has utterly transformed the way we think about each other and behave.
Yeah, I was about to just state the obvious that, okay, you talk about a lot of the ideas that have fed into this enormous change, this revolution, but the fact that these ideas came together with the smartphone and social media has surely just sped up the whole process. So we're in this strange new world. I think most of our viewers and listeners will be on board with that claim. How did we get here? Now, I know, obviously, the answer is go read this, or if you're a braver man than even me, go read this, the big one. I read the shorter one just because of time restraints, but and hope to get to the longer one at some stage. So that's the obvious answer. But what's the sort of the Cliff Notes answer to that?
I think the Cliff Notes answer is like there are various things that have happened that all of which have fed into this. I don't think we can look for a single cause of why we think the way we do. But I would say the number of things have happened over the last few hundred years that have all in some ways come together in this dramatic way. One of them would be, and this really begins with the Reformation or even the late medieval period, external authority has become a whole lot more complicated. Just think of religion, for example. If you were religious in the Middle Ages in Europe, the church has a massive authority. There is just the one church. You are going to be baptized, married, and buried in the one church in your village. That's going to be it. So the church, external institutions have tremendous authority in the Middle Ages. When we move into the modern age, though, when you think about the Reformation in some ways breaks the authority of the church in a powerful way. We have forces unleashed in the 19th century, intellectual forces, technological, industrial forces that remake communities, that reshape how people think about the solidity of the external world. So there's a story to be told there about the increasing weakening of traditional external authorities. There's an intellectual story that runs alongside it, whereby people become more and more interested in what's going on inside them, more and more interested in feelings. Now, you might say, well, surely people have always had feelings. Read the Psalms, read the Iliad. Achilles sulks. The psalmist laments. Well, yes, people always had inner feelings, but what happens really is external authorities get weaker. What we've seen occurring in the West over the last few hundred years is that inner feelings have been granted more and more authority. One could bring this out in a really dramatic way by saying, if 100 years ago, you or I had gone to our doctors and said, we think we're women trapped in men's bodies, doctor would have responded by saying, well, clearly there's a problem here. The problem is your mind. Let's work on your mind and bring it into consistency with your body. Today, you'll get the opposite answer. That's a problem. It's a problem with your body. Well, step back from judging whether who's right and who's wrong. Just reflect upon the difference in the way we're thinking about authority there. 100 years ago, the body had this solid authority over the mind in many ways. Now we tend to imagine the mind and its feelings to have the final say over the body. So there is this increasing, I describe it as an authorization of inner feelings. It's not that we have inner feelings for the first time in history. It's that we grant an importance to them that they've never really been given before. And then the third strand that I alluded to really in the first part of my answer is technology. Technology reshapes how we think about the world. One of the reasons why a doctor today can say, well, actually, it's a problem with your body. You are a woman and your body is problematic, is that we have technology that allows us to imagine that that answer is plausible. We can give people hormones. We can engage in plastic surgery. So there's a technological component to this as well. And of course, as I hinted in the first part, technology changes our view of external authority. I'm flying to Italy tonight. That would have been a lifetime's journey, a lifetime's journey, even 200 years ago. Now it's the second time I've done it in 12 months. It's nothing now. It's quicker for me to fly to Rome than it is for me to get the train to Seattle, for example.
Yeah.
Technology changes how we think about the solidity of the external world and external authority as well.
You give a marvelous sort of history, intellectual history of where the ideas come from. Now, you'll be familiar with Douglas Murray's diagnosis or perhaps description of the problem. Murray says everything was going well for civil rights, racial rights, gay rights, etc. And it was like a train was approaching the station and it was about to stop where it should have stopped, which is things are fine for gay rights, race rights, etc. But rather than stopping it, it sped right through the station and crashed into a whole bunch of other things. That's Murray's description. Now, some people are very critical of this description because this suggests all we need to do is go back to about sort of 2010. Things were fine in 2010 and we've gone overboard. I'm not sure if that's exactly what Murray would say, but that's one interpretation of what he's saying, that we've just gone too far. Now, you go much further back, but I know people that will go back to classical liberalism, and they'll say with classical liberalism what we had is liberty, is freedom, and when we emphasize freedom, we don't just get John Stuart Mill's notion of freedom, but we eventually get freedom from biology itself with the trans movement.
Yeah.
But I know even more, I know some Roman Catholics who go back to the Reformation, and that's why it's fun to put it to you, because there's no better to put to as a scholar of the Reformation and as someone who's written this book. They'll say the Reformation is the problem because, again, it's freedom. It's personal interpretation. I know I'm speaking as a Protestant, I should say, son of a Presbyterian minister.
I was going to say, as an Ulsterman as well.
An Ulsterman as well. I'm going to get in trouble from someone for saying this. But they'll say it was the Reformation. Essentially, the Reformation created this woke movement because you had freedom from authority, freedom from maybe natural law, personal individual interpretation of scripture, and you eventually get to where we are. Now, I imagine you reject that thesis. So,
yes, I reject it in a kind of qualified way, in the sense that part of me wants to say, well, first of all, if I was chatting to a Roman Catholic, and I have many Roman Catholic friends, and my response to them typically would be, you know, the Reformation is not the problem. Late medieval Catholicism is the problem, to which the Reformation is an answer. Now, as a Catholic, you're free to say it's the wrong answer. But please don't identify it as the problem. The problem pre-exists the Reformation. So, you know, you have three popes at the beginning of the 15th century. That's not doing a lot for papal authority, to be honest. First of all, there's the sort of the, you know, there's a historian card one can play. Secondly, I want to play the card of the printing press as well and says, okay, what about the printing press? You cannot have 13th century Catholicism once you have the printing press. Because once you have the printing press, literacy rates start to rise, political self-consciousness starts to rise. You're going to have, the system as established is going to come under fatal stress and is going to have to reconfigure itself. Maybe it didn't have to reconfigure itself as Protestantism, as we now know it, but something's going to happen. So I'd want to add that component to it as well. Thirdly, I think I'd want to move from those and say, you know, so there's not a lot of point in playing the blame game here. We are in the situation we are in. We can debate the origins of that. But let's look at the real problems of today and think about how we might be able to address them. And I'm more and more convinced that the real problem of our day is what I've called elsewhere a crisis in anthropology. That what we've lost sight of is what it means to be a human being. Classical liberalism worked because classical liberals still had a consensus on what it meant to be a human being. What we have now is a breakdown of the consensus about what it means to be a human being. And that's our problem. That's a huge problem as well. There's no easy answer to that. So to sort of circle back, is the Reformation responsible? Well, certainly the Reformation is part of the narrative of the West that gets us to where we are now. whether where we are now would have been avoidable if Martin Luther had never nailed his 95 Theses to the castle door in Wittenberg, I don't believe that. I think there are forces at play there that mean the medieval synthesis, or however you want to talk about it, was set to unravel. It unraveled in a Protestant direction. It didn't have to be that. But what I do know is 13th century Catholicism is not the answer. That world has gone, and it went long before the contemporary problems that we have.
That's a wonderful answer. I hope I was clear enough for our viewers and listeners. So again, the thesis is just that Protestantism put the emphasis on the individual interpreting scripture rather than on the church and receiving interpretation through the church. And the idea is that that emphasis on the individual eventually moved towards the individual interpreting reality. And then you have this sort of woke movement. Fascinating. Thank you, Carl. Now so we've covered what is this strange new world. How do we get here? Then in your final chapter, you discuss the question of what should we do about it? And this is a question we've been dealing with a lot on the show recently. We had a debate between James Orr and Dr. Dave Benson a few weeks asking the question, should we resist DEI, diversity, equality, and inclusion initiatives in the workplace and universities? And we've had a few other such discussions. In the last chapter of your book, you state this here: the era when Christians could disagree with the broader convictions of the secular world and yet still find themselves respected as decent members of society at large is coming to an end. And you've listed the sort of issues we're talking about here. We're not talking about your view on Christology, okay, or the Trinity. That's not what's going to get you in trouble these days. It's views on gay marriage, abortion, and the trans issue. Is that right?
Areas of sexual morality, broadly conceived, from reproductive rights all the way through to gender identity.
Yeah, and I guess some issues to do with certain areas of feminism, which comes under that. Now, you then put forward this notion of what you think, how you think Christians could respond, and you give Augustine and I think one or two of the early sort of church fathers as examples of that approach. Do you want to just outline briefly what that would be?
Yeah, I think there are various strands to the approach. What I like about Augustine is very clear that Christians and non-Christians share certain common interests in the world in which we live. So, for example, I have every interest in my house not being bombed by the Russians or the Luftwaffe or whoever it is at any given point in history. And I share that concern with my Jewish neighbors, my Muslim neighbors, et cetera, et cetera. And Augustine really offers a model where he sees it as quite legitimate for Christians to, we would say, I suppose today, engage in co-belligerence on issues we share in common. Last May, I had the interesting experience, privilege, honor of addressing a crowd at a Muslim liberal arts college on issues of gender. And I began the talk by saying, theologically, we have almost nothing in common. But hey, we have a vested interest in children's education. We want the streets to be safe for people to walk around of an evening. We have a lot of, what Augustine would say, sort of common loves we share. So I think one thing that Christians need to do is think about, who can we stand shoulder to shoulder with on the common concerns we have as social human beings? And I think that's very important. Secondly, I think we need to, and here I guess I'm working more from an American context than a British context. A lot of American Christians are always looking for the hill to die on. What's the issue where we can take on the government yet again? And I want to sort of counsel against that. Not everything the government does is bad. Not everything the government does has to be opposed. And I think the second century of the Christian church offers some interesting analogues for us, because in the second century, there's a big difference. We're living in societies that have known Christianity and are, deep, for want of a better term, de-Christianizing. Second century Roman world, they'd never known Christianity. So there's a big difference there. But given that difference, Christianity in the second century was typically regarded as immoral. Hey, they were cannibals. They ate body and blood of their god. They were incestuous. They called husband and wife called each other brother and sister. They were, and they wouldn't pledge allegiance at points to Caesar. They were seditious. It's interesting you mentioned earlier, you know, but we're not talking Christology here, of course. And I say to my students at college, I don't think anyone really ever gets persecuted for Christology. They get persecuted because the beliefs they hold are seen to be seditious in some way. So the second century church is a very, you know, similar to us in some ways. And the attitude of the Greek apologists, a group of thinkers and Christian leaders in the second century, was really to present the church as making people good citizens. And they were able to do that because they were only going to oppose the government on the issues where it really needed to be opposed. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, Roman soldiers arrive in your town and they're requiring that men sign up to join the army. That doesn't contradict the Christian faith. Roman soldiers arrive in your town and demand that you sacrifice to Caesar as a god. Yes. That contradicts the Christian faith. So you're going to fight on the one, but be a good citizen on the other. And what I want to, and again, I say I'm kind of coming from an American context here, trying to encourage conservative American Christians to think that, you know, we need to think carefully about the issues where we you know, engage in martial warfare, and the issues which are, hey, these are actually areas where they don't impinge upon the Christian faith. Obedience to the civil magistrate is not actually a sin in this context.
Yes. Brilliant. Okay, so this is very relevant to the sorts of discussions we've been having. So we've got Oliver O'Donovan and Stanley Harvass coming on to talk about some of the issues surrounding Christendom and wider society, etc. But I'm just thinking back to the discussion between James Orr and Dave Benson, because James's view was that essentially signing or pledging allegiance to the sort of the DEI movement is a bit like sacrificing to the emperor.
So
I think the key, I'm really with you there, because the question is, where is the, what is the hill to die on?
James put
forward publicly, so I'll say it again, that this DEI stuff is. Benson, obviously, it was a debate, so he was less clear about that. And so there's that. And then on the good citizen point, I think, 95% of the time we want to be good citizens, but then you've got Bonhoeffer, who was a horrendous citizen from the perspective of the Nazis.
Yeah, yeah.
But we all look back and we say, "Go on, you boy,
yeah." Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
you were a courageous man. So there's more to say, but do you want to respond at all to those points?
Yeah, I think first of all we need to just as a general comment, and it goes back in some ways to me talking about how fast things are changing. First of all, I think the questions are coming at us at a speed that we're not immediately often able to answer. So, for example, I think 5 years ago, I was asked, you know, what about if somebody demands they use that you use their preferred pronouns? And I'm pretty sure I gave a fairly equivocal answer on that in a way that I would not today, because I hadn't really had time to think about it. And I think as a Christian, it's always important to err on the side of caution and charity if you're not sure of the answer. So I think just as a general comment, it seems to me that it's perfectly legitimate for Christians to disagree on how to approach some of these things at this point, because some of these ideas are fairly new, and we only, you know, like they only work out the Trinity after 100 years of debates. Some of these things need to be debated, and it's great to hear that Dr. Benson and Dr. Orr are going head to head, because I think it's a great benefit to the rest of us to hear great minds wrestling with these things and doing so in good faith. Secondly, I think conscience is very, very important. A little bit like food sacrificed to idols. There may be some issues where somebody's conscience is very sensitive and tender. Like, the old example from my childhood and youth would have been, you know, the consumption of alcohol. That seems to me to be a conscience issue. If you think taking alcohol is wrong, then don't do it. You need to act in accordance with your conscience. Now, getting down to the nitty-gritty of things like DEI. You really got to think through, I think, at this point, what are you saying about the nature of what it means to be a human being when somebody asks you to sign these documents? And so my instinct, just in the brief summary you've given there, is to think that James Orr is more right than wrong on that issue. Mm. Now, what makes me cautious about saying that is I work at a college where this is not an issue for me.
Yeah.
And I'm always hesitant to state something as a moral imperative that costs me nothing to state and somebody else everything to obey. So there's that kind of modesty in what I'm saying here. But I do think that so much of modern identity politics demands the affirmation of the destruction of humanity. And you know, to use my own example, you know, 5 years ago, if somebody had said to me, what about preferred pronouns? I think the sort of answer I would have given was, well, I'd rather not, but I'm not sure that in every circumstance it would be wrong. Today, I'd give a different answer. Today, I would say, well, if the person's standing on the ledge of a skyscraper and the only way I can stop them from killing themselves is temporarily use their preferred pronouns to get them in, yes, I'm going to do that. Then I'm going to switch immediately. And the reason why is because 5 years ago when I thought about that issue, all I was thinking about was the person I'm speaking to. I don't want, you know, I don't want to hurt the person I'm speaking to. Now I think, what does it say to every other woman on the face of the planet when I use female pronouns for a male? Am I not actually a participant in the destruction of what it means to be a woman? Indeed, of what it means to be a human being at that point. So without going into every single example you could pull up, I would say for me, a big principle of judging, where do we draw the line? Where do we stand and fight? Or where do we draw the line and take the bullets? The issue of what it means to be a human being. And Bonhoeffer is a great example, actually, because you know if you read about Bonhoeffer, Bonhoeffer doesn't come easily to resistance. Luther. You know, he's a Lutheran. And Lutheranism tilts towards separation of
America
churches. And he goes through agonies in deciding that I can be involved in the resist against Hitler, and I want to say that it's a good thing that he didn't do the American thing and jump on at the first opportunity to have a pop. He really wrestled through the issues.
I'm 100% on board with that, although the objection would come if they'd done it earlier, they might have stopped it. You know, people, even 1931, some of the British politicians were saying we need to stop this now.
Yeah.
But of course, appeasement was followed. And but even if all of us, I think, agree, act sooner with World War II, but I think we can also agree. You got to sit down and think very hard and have the debates, have the discussions, wrestle with your conscience. You have to be really serious about it. And that's part of what we're trying to do on this show. A few thoughts was, yes, we had James Lindsay on last episode. He's the guy who did the academic hoax. Not a Christian and an atheist, but I mean, he had a pretty strong view on the pronouns issue. He really thinks it's sort of that slow creep towards totalitarianism if you're going along with it. And to go back briefly to Benson Orr, I mean, I just hosted the debate. I didn't give my own view. Benson will say correctly that if, you know, there are many different ways of thinking of DEI.
Yeah.
And of course we could sit, I actually disagreed with James on this, but we could sit around and come up with a Christian articulation of it. But the question is, in terms of the situation on the ground, is there a coherent ideology behind DEI? And I'm inclined to disagree with Benson and think, roughly speaking, there is sort of a secular ideology that does have coherence to it and that is being pushed, and it's not only not Christian, but it's hostile to what we're doing now. One or two more thoughts here. There's another great quote, which is just tying into what you said. You said, I am suggesting, rather, that engaging in cultural warfare using the world's tools, rhetoric, and weapons is not the way for God's people. Now, I thought this was really interesting. We've thought about Bonhoeffer. I guess what do you have in mind when you say engaging in cultural warfare using the world's tools, rhetoric, and weapons? Because my first thought was, does that sort of ultimately entail some sort of pacifism? Because of course, if you were to engage with the Allies against Hitler in World War II, in a just war, you are using the world's tools. I mean, literally the guns and everything. I mean, that's not what we're talking about with this situation. We're talking about sort of non-violent resistance. But yeah, do you want to clarify what you're saying?
Yeah, I don't mean pacifism. What I mean is what my father would have called, you know, standards of decency in the way we behave.
Okay.
You know, I think of Paul. You know, Paul is quite happy to call on his Roman citizenship. You know, he has this legal right, and he will use it to his advantage at the moment it comes up. So I'm really thinking there, again, against the background of a politics that has become so dirty and so personal and so win at any cost. Christians cannot win at any cost.
Of course,
we have to honor our Lord as we do so. So not saying, no, we just, you know, sit back and wait for it all to happen, or we run up a hill and live in isolated communities. What I'm pressing for there, and perhaps should have expressed it more clearly, is, you know, we need to make sure that as and when we operate in the civic realm, we do so in a way that brings no dishonor to the name of Christ.
Yes. Oh, completely. You don't play dirty. Yeah.
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 Which means we're always at a disadvantage, of course. That is the problem.
You know, yeah.
We have to work 10 times as hard to get half the results because we have to play by the rules and our opponents do not.
I completely agree. I think if you're willing to, the older I get, I'm 36, just turned 36.
That's young, man.
The older I get, the older I get, the more I see that if you're willing to lie, and if you're willing to maliciously malign your opponents, it works in the short term.
Yeah.
And of course, Christians, we have to say no to both.
Yeah.
We're going to tell the truth. And we have enemies and we may oppose them, but we're not going to malign them.
Yeah.
We're not going to spread false rumors about them. But I completely agree. That's very well put. It does, in the short term, it puts you at a disadvantage, which is an interesting thought. Because when I read it, I thought about figures like Chris Rufo, who's really, I mean, whether you agree with him or not, he's certainly having an effect.
Oh, yeah. And a very positive one on the whole. Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of, he obviously worked with DeSantis. I think he's a Christian. I'm not 100% sure. I tried Googling. But then you have people like Matt Walsh and Candace Owens, who are both Christian. Matt Walsh is Catholic. And they're very much pushing back. Now, a lot of people don't like them for obvious reasons because they're pushing back against something. Sometimes people take issue with their tone. I know some Christians took issue with the tone of Matt Walsh's What is a Woman?
Which I was in, of course.
You were in it.
I was in it, yes.
Goodness.
So interestingly,
I watched it a year.
One reviewer, in light of your comment, one reviewer, Abigail Favale at the University of Notre Dame, who actually is somebody you should have on this podcast, Catholic gender theorist.
Yes.
She said
Genesis
that
of gender,
that's right. Her criticism of the movie was the only person who used the word compassion in the entire movie was me. So I took that as a plus for me. But I did think afterwards, we do need... There's the political issue, and I think Matt Walsh deals with the political and cultural stuff well. But we also need to remember that with something like transgenderism, there are a myriad individuals whose lives are just being torn apart by this.
Yeah.
And that's a difficult balance to strike, I think.
It is really difficult. And I think the question there is satire, because it's essentially... Walsh said himself, he joked he wanted to make a lot of money from the show.
I'm sure he did.
And he wanted it to be entertaining. That was a key thing.
Yeah.
And of course, if you want it to be entertaining, you make it funny.
Yeah.
And it is an interesting debate over satire, because of course, satire is supposed to be funny, but it's supposed to make a point.
It's supposed to sting a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. It's supposed to sting a little bit, but get a message through. And I think that's an interesting one to consider. But yeah, I see what you're saying. So using legal means, William Wilberforce, all that, pushing back, but doing it in a way that's decent. Well, of course, I'm completely on board with that.
And I think, you know, when you think about the trans issue in particular, you know, why it's the one thing that makes my blood boil, or more than anything else, because kids are being damaged and affected by it.
Yeah.
And it's, I think as a Christian, we have, and this came across when I was chatting to the Muslims in May, you know, as a Christian, I feel I have an obligation to speak up for the weak who can't speak up for themselves. And if adults are not prepared to be adults and protect children, people have got to point that out and stand up for that. And so yeah. I think on that issue yeah. in particular, we're dealing yeah. with the damage done to children.
100%, because I know that one of the messages you hear from some Christian leaders is, look, we don't want to engage in these sort of cultural battles. We don't want to take sides. Yeah. We want to be peacemakers and stuff. And, you know, I think that's coming from a good place.
Yeah.
But when you watch the documentaries about children who have had double mastectomies, yeah. they've had their genitals removed and they regret it and they feel this terror, this yeah. sense of what the hell have I just done? Yeah. That's what it's about. It's not just like a battle of ideas that has no consequence in some people's lives. Yeah. It really does. And I think, you know, Matt Walsh, I mentioned that criticism of the show. I actually didn't have that criticism myself. I was pretty positive about it.
I thought it was very moving, particularly the testimony of the young woman who tried to become a man and was now wanting to revert back to being a woman. It was just mm-hmm. heartbreaking to listen yeah. to that testimony. It really yeah. put a human face on the problem.
That's right. That's right. And it seems to have a pretty big effect. Carl, we could go on for a long time on these issues, or we could just get into Reformation theology, which I'd love to. But really brilliant. So it's Strange New World and the Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. You really want to understand the ideas behind it. Now, one brief thought I had with this. Did you deal with Foucault and Derrida?
No. There's a limit to what you can deal with. I really, a couple of reasons. One, I'm much more familiar with the Frankfurt School and the kind of the Marxist tradition of critical theory. But secondly, I think that the basic issues, whether it's Foucault or whether it's Marcuse, the basic issue, the criticism of power, the anti-essentialism, the negation of what is, both streams of critical theory kind of share that in common. So yeah. I didn't want to get bogged down in the first. And to be honest, I also find Derrida and Foucault much less interesting to read than I find sort of the traditional 100%, Marxist tradition.
100%. Sometimes, you know, because I'm at home, I just love reading like theology and philosophy and stuff. Now, I feel from a cultural point of view, I feel some duty to go and read some of this stuff. But the idea of spending a month or two on Foucault and Derrida, maybe I'm underselling them, but
I do look at Judith Butler, of course, and she draws both on the Marxist Hegelian tradition and also Foucault as well. So that they're both there in Judith Butler. I actually have a little book coming out later this year on the Frankfurt School, which is a sort of spin-off of this.
Oh, very good. So, is that an accessible book?
Yeah, it was commissioned by Broadman and Holman, a Southern Baptist press, who wanted a book they could give to undergraduates in their college system to familiarize them with Frankfurt School stuff. So I can arrange for you to get a copy if you send me your
signed
address.
Copy would be,
I can add you to the list.
Signed copy would be amazing. Just for our viewers and listeners, that's a bit tactical, but basically, so Foucault and Derrida are just classic postmodernists, and the Frankfurt School are a group of essentially mostly Marxists. Do you want to just give us 30 seconds on the Frankfurt School?
Yeah, I deal with the Frankfurt School somewhat in the larger book. I can't remember the extent I dealt with them in the shorter book, but in the larger book, the Frankfurt School are really interested in why is it that the revolution happens in Russia where there's no industrial working class, but doesn't happen in Germany where there is an industrial working class? And why is it that the working class follow Hitler and not the Communist Party? Mm. And that takes them into areas of thinking about what shapes human consciousness, what shapes human identity. And that's the sort of the springboard for a lot of modern identity politics. So Herbert Marcuse, who's wrestling with the problem of Nazism in the 30s and 40s, is a guru in 1968 for the sexual revolutionaries of the student movements in Europe and America. So there is a connection there.
Brilliant. Carl, thank you so much for giving of your time to join us. You're getting on a flight this evening.
I am.
To Italy. So we really appreciate it. To our viewers and listeners, do check out those books. Do subscribe. Let us know what you think in the comments. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. But for now, Carl, thank you so much for joining us.
Been a pleasure, Luke. Thanks for having me on.
Cheers.